This is the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting Thursday, February 15th, 2001 at 1 p.m., room 343.
And the first issue on our agenda is you have an agenda. You might want to take a look at it. There's no committee meeting on Monday. And for those who are attending, there's a field trip to the Donald E. Long Juvenile Facility on Tuesday, so our next meeting for the purpose of hearing bills will be on Wednesday. With that, we're going to go into a work session on Senate Bill 183. Senator, Council, why don't you tell us what we're doing?
Ms. Metzger. We're going, John. We're going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate Bill 183 is back before us. As you may recall, this is the bill that was sponsored by Senator Metzger and Senator Courtney. This is regarding Department of Corrections and their ability to have inmates in the Department of Corrections pay for their costs of care, and believe that before the committee is the bill, and there are four sets of amendments before the bill. And I don't know if Senator Metzger would like me to explain the amendments, or would you like
Remind me, Council, is this the bill that the governor's office has amendments to?
Yeah.
And these are their amendments? Or?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the... this is the bill that we had a member of the governor's office here testifying. I think the committee, first of all, had some questions about after Steve Dole had testified about how this the cost of care and having the inmate pay for that. How is that dynamic work with the restitution that an inmate has to pay and the unitary assessments? I think that if you have SB 183-2 amendments, that is the amendment that I asked LC to draft to deal with the concerns raised by the committee, so that when the Department of Corrections is going through the assessment of an inmate's ability to pay, the DOC must consider the person's need for funds to pay for the support of a person's children and to pay any monetary obligations imposed on the person as a result of the person's conviction. Again, that would encompass the unitary assessments, which are assessed to a defendant upon conviction, and I'm sure you're all aware those monies are then given to victims' funds and different funds to use to fund those programs, and then the restitution. So that was the one amendment that I asked for after some questions on behalf of the committee. Senate Bill 183-3 amendments, Mr. Chairman, are the ones that I worked with Scott Taylor from the Department of Corrections, and that was Scott Taylor was here with the gentleman from the governor's office, and these are the amendments that they requested. And their concern in these amendments was to make sure that the Department of Corrections did not have to look at each inmate's situation and make a determination of their ability to pay. And this was a concern because I think the Department of Corrections realized very early on when working with with Senator Metzger was, you know, the large majority of inmates will not have assets to pay for their care. So that's dash three amendments. And frankly, the dash four amendments, I don't know where they come from. And if there is a proponent that had LC draft those here, I'd love to hear from them. And I don't feel like I could adequately explain those at this time.
Okay. Can't explain them, we won't adopt them. How about that? All right, Senator Metzger, we're in work session.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Council explained them well. The dash one was requested. I don't think we clarified that one. Was that in the rare occasion that someone could be in the Department of Corrections and make a legal challenge for false imprisonment? We're not sure how that would happen in the Department of Corrections, and to actually be adjudicated in their favor and win a settlement, that the state then couldn't just take that settlement away and therefore make themselves immune from falsely imprisoning somebody in the Department of Corrections. While that, we don't know of any such instance, that certainly would sound like a fair situation.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Musgrave, I might be able to give some background on that. In other states that have similar bills or laws on the books where inmates are to pay for their costs of care, there have been one situation arose where a inmate won a federal claim against the prison for some civil rights violations, and the institution, once that claim was paid to him, then just attached that claim and said, we'll take that money to pay for your care. And the courts frowned upon that. This is an amendment that I believe Ingrid Swenson worked with Senator Metzger on to deal with a situation like that where it has been found that a person has been falsely imprisoned. I think that obviously policy-wise we wouldn't want then to set the Department of Corrections to say, okay, you've been falsely imprisoned, here's $3,000, and in fact we'll take that $3,000 because it cost $5,000 to imprison you.
Yeah, right.
So that's the idea. If that was a bit circular, that's because it is a circular idea, and I think that's what this amendment's trying to deal with.
And Mr. Chair, I said that was certainly fine.
And I'm assuming that the suit that this inmate won was one relevant to false imprisonment for the imprisonment they were currently serving, as opposed to some other.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That is correct. And the concern was, as I stated, the policy of allowing the institution to do that after it's been found to have violated the inmate's rights.
Okay.
Do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Do we do these separately?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 183.
Okay. Senator Metzger moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 183. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Metzger.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 183.
Senator Metzger moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 183. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Metzger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to amend the proposed amendment, if we may do that. Would that be correct, Mr. Counsel?
Well, Senator Metzger, Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I was hoping that Mr. Taylor, Scott Taylor, was here because this was an amendment that I worked on with Mr. Taylor. And my concern when I read it from LC, if you look at the Dash 3 amendment, this, again, was intended to incorporate the situation where DOC does not want to have to spend money assessing the ability to pay of every inmate, because clearly, as we talked earlier and heard from Dale Penn and Josh Marquis and Steve Dole, most inmates will not have the ability to pay. It's going to be those unique situations where an inmate has assets, as Josh Marquis had mentioned, the case where the defendant had a $200,000 life insurance policy that paid out when he killed his wife, unfortunately, and that went into his own assets. My concern was, I wanted to make sure with Mr. Taylor that you wanted the amendments the way they are, because I was concerned that the first portion of them, as they read, when the DOC has actual knowledge that a person confined in a department institution has substantial assets that are available and subject to collection for the full cost of care, I wanted to make sure that you wanted those amendments in there on behalf of the department. So,
come on up, Scott. Help us with this.
And specifically, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I wanted to make sure to ask Mr. Taylor, there may be a situation where the Department of Corrections has an inmate, knows that the inmate has assets, but does not want to go, proceed and take those assets to pay for costs of care. That was my concern. Is that true, Mr. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, Scott Taylor, Oregon Department of Corrections, that is correct. And I've looked at the adjustments you made to the amendment, and I think they work for us. Thank you for...
All right, just for the record, the intent of the amendment is to do what?
The intent of the amendment is to make sure that we have the ability to go and determine whether people have the ability to pay on a select group of people, that we don't have to screen everybody that comes through and go search their entire financial history, that we can act more selectively in finding those assets when we have knowledge to that effect.
Right. Now, I've got a couple of questions. Does this term actual knowledge, is that a higher threshold than just knowledge?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't think that that is a different... in law, there you can be imputed to have knowledge. I think that it's just an... Senator Courtney?
Well, I don't mean that. May I suggest that there is a constructive knowledge and there's active knowledge, actual knowledge? I believe, Mr. Chair, we're talking about you got to have actual knowledge. You cannot be held to constructive knowledge, if you understand, Mr. Chair. And I know you understand that as a police officer, what I'm talking about. I believe that's what we mean by actual. The word actual does have a huge meaning in this. It has a huge meaning here.
Well, see, and what it means to me, and I could be wrong, is that you would have to have something in your hand that gives reason to believe that this person has assets, maybe a bank statement. It wouldn't just be somebody that says, hey, I think Bob won a lawsuit 3 years ago and he still has it in a bank account somewhere. Help me with this.
I think you're right, given the fact scenario, Mr. Chair, you gave me, but... I think that if there had been a major newspaper story on an individual who had won the lottery and it was general knowledge through the media that they had won the lottery, I think that's an actual knowledge situation, short of having something physical in your hands. And I could be wrong, Mr. Chair, and Supreme and I learned counsel, but I'm trying to do a fact situation to try to flesh this out.
Well, and the reason I'm doing this is because we have a P.G. Bowley case.
Right.
And if the court's looking at this and they're saying actual knowledge, actual knowledge to the court means actual knowledge. And so if there is a specific legal term and meaning defined by that, I think maybe we need to know what that is.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I just want to make sure I understand what I think the DOC would like to not have to assess every inmate and make a decision on every inmate. Are we going to try to assess costs of care for this inmate? And I think there might be a better way to do that. I didn't mean to just take out the portion, but I know that that's the intent of Department of Corrections, and maybe I would probably be more comfortable to work with LC on dealing with what this amendment proposed amendment would do.
One other issue too, it also says substantial assets, and again, I'm not sure what
that
means.
What does that mean?
So as opposed to assets, so, I mean, if you want flexibility. It seems to me like words like knowledge without actual in front of it makes better sense, because that gives you the ability to judge a little broader. And just simply assets, and you can make a determination as to whether the assets are sufficient for the department to go after. And then the most important part is the may elect not to
right. Language.
That seems most important to me.
Mr. Chair, if I could, the council had a suggestion, I think, to address that issue. Maybe you could present that, what you discussed with Mr. Taylor on line four, to maybe solve all those issues.
Well, and my suggestion, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, was to basically delete the proposed amendment up to line four, the word the, so the amendment would read, the department may elect not to investigate a person's ability to pay or elect not to issue an ability to pay order. But my concern with this... I got this, took a look at this morning, is that talks about the department looking at the ability to pay. The real issue we want to look at is the department going to try to get the assets and is going to try to seek a claim against them. So I made that suggestion. I'm not completely comfortable with proceeding on it right now until I talk to LC.
Senator Mesker, would you be comfortable if we put this over?
Yes, absolutely. Let's do that.
I'd like to do that if I could just put it over till Wednesday until we clarify some of that language. Is that okay with you, Scott?
Yes, Chair.
No protest?
No. And, Chair, if I could just say I appreciate the conversation. Some of the terminology that's in there came from legal counsel trying to help us draft this.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Scott. Appreciate it. And we'll close the public hearing then on Senate Bill, the work session on Senate Bill 183. We'll come back on Wednesday the 21st, February 2001, to finish that discussion. And right, we'll do the public hearing on Senate Bill 166. 6. Now, is that Senator, let me quick pull this, the young guy?
No.
Okay, good. I promised him that he
get out, buddy.
Get down to
your services are no longer required.
All right, counsel.
It's really cruel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill would create a cause of action for killing a companion animal. It would establish an age requirement for rabies inoculation. It changes some reporting to local health officials. And it clarifies the procedure and findings required before ordering a dog to be killed and establishes a separate court proceeding with a separate appealable order.
All right. I am assuming that Rob, is it Bravette, and Scott Beckstead, are you going to speak together?
Mr. Beckstead is actually Colorado, Mr. Chair.
For Scott, I'm
yes.
Sorry. You're first up. Are you the proponent of the bill, or is this your puppy?
This is your puppy.
So speak? Not today.
That's it.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I introduced this bill on behalf of Scott Beckstead you were talking about. So what it's worth, I just put that on the record. So,
So Scott then is the proponent. And
correct.
Rob, you're there here.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding Senate Bill 166. My name is Rob Bovette. I'm a lawyer from Lincoln County. And I'm here at the request of Scott Beckstead, who called me late yesterday afternoon. He's in Colorado now, and that's why he's not here today. I'm here to address generally what Senate Bill 166 does, but then to focus on one particular aspect that affects part of what my job is in Lincoln County as the Lincoln County Dog Judge. As counsel summarized, basically Senate Bill 166 is aimed at three things. First off, it's aimed at providing a civil cause of action for those who, against those who essentially wrongfully kill a companion pet. And I will leave that issue to some other proponents of the bill to discuss in more detail unless you have specific questions for me. That doesn't affect me directly in what I do in Lincoln County. The second significant thing that it does is it amends the rabies statutes to basically update them. Our rabies statutes are slightly overbroad in the sense that they technically require, for example, that a rabies vaccination be given to a dog that's, I believe, under 6 months old, where you can't give a rabies vaccine to those types of animals, as I understand it. And again, there are other proponents and experts on those topics that will talk about that issue today. The third big aspect of Senate Bill 166 is some fine-tuning and some substantive changes to the dog control law in ORS Chapter 609, and that does impact some of what I do in Lincoln County and also impacts how I work with Scott Beckstead on various cases. And I've briefly charted out on the board here for you because within that rubric of how we deal with dog control issues, and I'm talking about incidents where dogs either chase or bite a person or another domestic pet. And we're not talking about livestock because that's a whole other set of laws and that's not impacted by Senate Bill 166. We're talking about where a dog chases or bites another person or a companion pet. And basically, as a practical matter, here's the way it works in reality. A law enforcement officer that's called out to a scene where you've got a chase incident or a bite incident really has four options that we can talk about. Two of them are unrealistic, and two of them are realistic in terms of what happens out there in the real world. The first is the law enforcement officer can do nothing and ignore it. Now, yes, that may happen, but as a practical matter, that's not what comes to me. That's not what comes to the courts. And usually when you've got a complainant there that's been bitten, the officer is going to do something. The second option under the statute as it exists today is to issue a citation. The citation takes the person into circuit court. In Lincoln County, we have recently discovered that process doesn't work too well for a real practical reason. If a dog owner is cited into court and the judge later determines that the dog needs to be euthanized, you can imagine what happens immediately after court is over. The dog owner runs home and the dog basically becomes a fugitive. And we have a number of fugitive dogs in Lincoln County as a result of Option 2. And so in Lincoln County, we're generally not exercising Option 2 anymore. The real two options are Option 3 and 4 under the statute. The third option is for the officer, the law enforcement officer, the animal control officer, to impound the dog. In that case, it comes to me on behalf of the Board of Commissioners as the Lincoln County dog judge. Some counties have a board, some counties have a referee, whatever you call it. The county decides what to do with the dog. And the options generally range from putting the dog on some sort of structure, in Lincoln County we call it probation, and we have probation conditions, all the way to killing or euthanizing the dog in appropriate cases. The fourth option is really a combination, because the statute authorizes the law enforcement officer to do both a citation and an impound. In those cases, because the citation was then issued, generally go to circuit court, and the circuit court has a range of options. And the reason I call your attention to the number 3 and 4 is because this bill really addresses both of those. And I'm going to be talking primarily about number 3, and we also have here today from Lincoln County our circuit court judge, Judge Branford, who handles most of the issues that crop up under number 4. I anticipate that he'll have some concerns about the way this bill proposes to amend that statute, particularly ORS 609-990 in Section 11 of the bill. I'm going to be talking primarily about how it affects us in the impound area and why I can say that we support, or I support in my personal capacity, what Senate Bill 166 does in that area. And I can say that because I think what it does is make some technical amendments to that area of the law to make things work a little better. Most notably, as counsel mentioned, with appeals. Currently, we have a process where, for example, if I issue an order directing that a dog be euthanized that has been impounded for chasing or biting a person, it kind of leaves everybody in a quandary as to what to do. We've been using the writ of review process, which is fine, but it's not speedy, and people can wait a while, and it leaves the county not knowing exactly what to do. This bill essentially imposes a 10-day statute of limitations or deadline. If I issue an order of euthanization, then the person who owns the dog has 10 days to appeal on a writ of review, and a disposition of the dog is stayed pending outcome of that circuit court case. And so it adds that additional layer explaining what you do specifically and giving statutory guidance in that particular circumstance. It also clarifies a dog is a public nuisance in terms of some of the things are slightly, in Mr. Beckstead's opinion, and I share that opinion, overbroad in the public nuisance statute. For example, a dog is a public nuisance and can be impounded and brought through the process for scattering garbage. And this would create an exception if the dog scatters garbage on the owner's own property. We figure that's an owner problem. The owner needs to clean up the garbage. He's essentially sanctioned on the spot rather than having the dog impounded, cited, what have you. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I do want to note one thing I spoke with Scott about yesterday, or Mr. Beckstead about yesterday, is he wants the committee to be fully aware that this was his draft that was submitted with a gracious acceptance of Senator Courtney, and it was the first draft, and it's in the hopper. And Scott wants you to know that if there are legitimate concerns, and he anticipates some now from discussions with a number of individuals, including Judge Branford, that some concerns may come up. And Scott would definitely like the opportunity, if the committee sees fit, to work out some amendments to Senate Bill 166 to take care of maybe some overbreadth problems in Senate Bill 166 if we're covering too much territory and we need to tune it up. So, and I'm willing to work with Scott and with Judge Branford or whoever happens to be concerned about aspects of Senate Bill 166.
All right, any questions? Senator Brigg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I was a little unclear. You only want to talk to the specific parts of the bill that deal with the citation process and so on?
I'm happy to attempt to answer questions if you have some regarding, for example, Section 1 of the bill dealing with the cause of action or the rabies issues in later sections, but I'm most familiar with the sections of the bill that go from, I think, Section 6 to Section 11, which is the dog control amendments.
Okay, I do have some questions on those areas. One is that you say that the dog can be defined as a public nuisance for aggressively biting a person. It looks to me like you've changed the existing law to change it from biting to aggressively biting.
Right.
And yet the notion of aggressively biting is not defined anywhere in the bill. Can you say what you're talking about and what the difference is between an aggressive bite and any
sure.
other old bite?
I think I can express to you what Mr. Beckstead was trying to get at with this particular amendment, and he may not have been successful. And I believe that primarily you'll hear some issues concerning the use of aggressively throughout these sections from Judge Branford, and I share some of those concerns. He was trying to get at the issue of where you've got a bite that is a result of a playful incident, where the dog is not truly aggressive towards anyone. He's not chasing anybody. You have a bite incident that occurs. It has to be reported to the health division or the local health department under the statute, and it's a playful bite. And so there really isn't a need to issue a citation or do an impound in that type of situation. And he was trying to confine the definition of public nuisance to that type of circumstance. So inserting aggressively may be going too far, and I think Mr. Beckstead is more than happy to either define that term and get at what he wants to get at, or maybe substitute some other language for that.
Yeah, that would probably be appropriate, because if you have a dog that playfully bites a two-year-old and puts his eye out, that could be a different situation.
Could be a significant issue.
The other question I had is, and I should know the dog statutes by now, because we've dealt with them a lot before, but this basically has a scenario where if it's a companion dog, non-economic damages can be quite high, $250,000. And yet, it looks to me like the maximum fine if the dog does something, the owner of that dog has a maximum liability of $500. Do you think there's a little disconnect there in terms of responsibility?
Well, except that they're in, Mr. Chair, Senator, they're in different contexts. One's in the criminal context, where the state is essentially imposing a fine for keeping a dog as a public nuisance, whereas in Section 1 we're addressing a cause of action where a person usually intentionally causes the death of a companion animal, more akin to intentional infliction of emotional distress, a civil cause of action.
You know, and I understand that, and I assume that under the civil law, because humans are already covered under the civil law, that comparable damages would be allowed if someone caused serious damage to a human. Maybe counsel would comment on that. If someone damaged, they could get comparable damages to this $250,000.
There would be no statutory limit to that.
Right. Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, just another couple of questions on the. You talk about intentionally or negligently, willful, wanton or negligent act or omissions if you cause the death of an animal. I come from Multnomah County, and Multnomah County dog control tells me that in many cases they rely on Good Samaritans to help bring dogs in who are perhaps hit by a car, perhaps hit by their car, and that they rely on them. And if you had these high potential liabilities, that perhaps you would encourage Good Samaritans not to help dogs in distress. What is your feeling on that?
Mr. Beckstead shared concerns with me about how he drafted this section initially to cover not just intentional wanton conduct, but also negligent conduct, and he seems more than amenable. He anticipates you'll, in fact, hear today some objections over that negligence, that very issue, and he was not intending to cover that type of scenario at all, and would be more than amenable to working some amendments to Section 1 to confine it to really where you've got a bad actor, where you've got someone who's intentionally, wantonly, willingly killing someone else's companion animal.
Right, and that would not, I think it's important to take drivers who may be driving too fast and may be at fault in the situation, but nevertheless they didn't intend any harm to the animal. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on what Senator Burdick had to say on subsection 2, line 10 of the first page, where it says, person who by willful, wanton, or negligent act. The way I would read that, and tell me if I'm wrong, that would a negligent act on my part be to allow my dog, who's off leash, who's off and then kills your dog, that I am then negligent for my dog killing your dog? Would that be how you would read that? Because I was negligent and then I didn't have him on leash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yes, and that is not the intent of the drafters of this bill, and hence why I think Mr. Beckstead is more than willing to refine that terminology to make sure that it's just the intentional bad actor that we're looking at here under Section 1.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions? None? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Mr. Branford, Circuit Court Judge. Your Honor.
Ooh.
Planning on being a bit here?
Yeah.
Are you planning on being here?
Just a couple days. I work for the state in my head, in my briefcase.
I can loan you one. I got an extra one.
Mr. Chair, I'll be back when he gets to the executive summary.
I'm fine if the dog does something. The owner of that dog has a maximum liability of $500. Questions on the, you talk about intentionally or negligently, willful, wanton. You had these high potential liabilities. Right, and that would not, I think it's important to take drivers who may be driving too fast and may be at fault in the situation, but nevertheless they didn't intend any harm to the animal. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on what Senator Burdick had to say on subsection 2, line 10, the first page, where it says, a person who by willful, wanton, or negligent act.
I think Walter Arson sent him over here.
We need to get our briefcase. I feel bad for this.
Clear the table.
These need my wheelbarrow. What kind of trouble did I get myself into?
Can you give us a minute until we go through the material, Mr. Chair?
Obviously, it'll take us right into the courtroom. Thank you.
Your Honor?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Branford. I'm a circuit judge in Newport. I found out about this hearing about 4 o'clock yesterday, so I'm quite disorganized, and that's my problem, not yours. I do want to start by giving thanks to my staff, Judy Reed and Lynn Craig, who put this thing together on very short notice. This issue started, I just want to give a real brief history. About 2.5 years ago, I was frustrated because the laws were so inadequate regarding dog control and the penalties that could be imposed, particularly in dog bite situations, that kind of got the ball rolling. And then 2 years ago, the legislature made some significant changes to the laws that I think were very welcome. And let me switch then first to just what we're talking about. Thank goodness for the internet. From the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, there's a national estimate of 333,000 dog bite injuries each year in emergency rooms, 4.7 million total, approximately 17 deaths annually from dog bites, 5,991 hospital discharges for dog bite injuries in 1994, so that's people that were actually hospitalized, not just taken to an ER. The hospital bills alone, not including the medical bills, ranged between $4,600 for teenagers up to close to $7,000 for children and elderly people. And that doesn't include the doctor's bills or the expenses people incur after getting out of the hospital and leaving the doctor. And it says that the numbers may well be underestimates. So it's a significant problem in a financial sense and in a personal sense and in a loss sense. What I gave you was all of the cases. I got, shall we say, bitten in October in an Oregonian article about this, the dog law and how it was being implemented in Lincoln County. And the suggestion was that I had run amok and was killing dogs wantonly and indiscriminately. Part of what my staff has done is to keep track of the cases we've had in Lincoln County since the new law went into effect. And what they did was they ran an OJ inquiry about all the cases, and then my JA went and she read through each file to find ones that had a dog bite allegation in it, and we came up with 16. Of those 16 defendants, there were four dogs ordered destroyed. In each case, it was one individual with two dogs. In other words, two dogs acting in concert. In one case, biting a person. In another case, menacing a person. So what I'm saying is, statistically, in one out of eight cases, I've ordered destruction of a dog. In other cases, I've imposed reasonable conditions or simply a fine. So I wanted to respond to that because it was, offensive to me, the way it was characterized. So that's what you have. You have a copy of all the decisions that I've made, and you have a copy of the front back of the citation. And in the cases in which I ordered destruction of the dog, the police reports are attached. In one, you'll find a woman was bitten while jogging, and that had been preceded by a postal carrier who had been assaulted or attacked by the same dogs, but who succeeded in getting away by jumping into a car that happened to be passing by at the moment. The other case involved a person with repeat instances of dog at large, dog as public nuisance, neighbors complaining about being terrified, and finally attacking a poodle that an elderly man was carrying, and the elderly man was knocked down in the course of the fracas. So that's what you have there, so you can see with your own eyes what's been happening in Lincoln County. Part of the idea behind the amendment of the laws 2 years ago was to take out requirements for intentional, knowing, reckless, or criminally negligent conduct with respect to vulnerability to a conviction for a charge involving a dog bite. At the time, I mentioned that there are other statutes in Oregon that eliminate the need for a culpable mental state simply because the result you're trying to prescribe is so dangerous that it's a strict liability situation, that if you allow something to happen, you're liable. And from yesterday's metro section of the Oregonian, we have an example. It's the story about the girl from Corvallis who on her 14th birthday died with a 0.31 blood alcohol content. And there are allegations currently that two adult women may have been involved in furnishing alcohol to the kids. Now, in this incident, there would be no requirement of proof that she intentionally or knowingly made it available. In other words, if you're 25 and you allow somebody who's 20 to have a beer, you're automatically liable because you weren't positive of the person's age. And it expresses the legislative intent of protecting younger people. In this case, a 14-year-old girl. The thought was that because dog bites can be serious, the same sort of liability should attach. And that's why, partly why the statute exists as it does today from the amendments from the 1999 legislature. The thing I find most offensive in this Senate Bill 166 is contained in Section 10, and Senator Burdick already talked about it, and that is the modification of biting a person to a requirement that a dog aggressively bite a person before a dog could be found to be, or the owner could found to be a public nuisance, or that the dog is a public nuisance. That only enhances the burden of proof on a victim. Most of these incidents, there's no police officer there. You simply have somebody out walking down the street or jogging down the street, and do you want to add the onus to them that they be able to characterize the nature of the bite? I think not. In other words, that's a factor the court can consider. Like in the cases I've given you, there are occasions you'll find in there where I didn't order any fine, but only restitution for the bite. In other cases, a $10 fine, depending on how the owner reacted to the incident. And so I suggest that because there are statutory criteria that a court is to consider before deciding to euthanize a dog, that is the protection for the dog owner and for the dog that society needs to make available. And the legislature should not make it more difficult for a person to prove that they've been that a dog is a nuisance by having to approve the nature of the bite. I have absolutely no problem with the idea about modifying subsection B, subsection D, about activities occurring on the premises of the keeper of the dog. I don't like number F. It says, without justification, disturbing any person by frequent or prolonged noises. I have had cases of chronic all day long barking when people aren't home, and it drives people nuts. And I think that the without justification isn't necessary. In other words, a court can make a determination of how aggravated the circumstance is and impose anywhere from a no fine at all up to $250, and the court can consider the justification factors in determining whether or not some kind of fine should be imposed. Last time there was a modification not only to the ability to euthanize a dog, but the ability of a court to impose reasonable restrictions on the keeping of the dog, and that's been done several times in Newport. And to my everlasting regret, I forgot something really important last time, and I'm delighted to have a chance here to try to bring it up, and that is, what happens if the dog or the owner doesn't comply with the reasonable restrictions that are imposed? In other words, if you choose to do that instead of euthanizing a dog, I forgot about what to do if the person didn't comply. And I suggest that it would be appropriate to add language that says that if there are circumstances that would otherwise justify euthanizing a dog, but instead the court imposes reasonable restrictions, if they're not honored, that the court could still then, after another court hearing, authorize the destruction of the dog, if the person won't do what they're supposed to. And then there's an ancillary issue, and this is off the chart, not in the statute, and it has to do with the San Francisco situation, the woman that was killed. This morning I sent an email to about 10 judges asking the question, if this were to happen in Oregon, what charge could be filed against that person? Or should there be a charge that could be filed against the dog owner in the circumstances of that woman's death? It's my belief, and I would say that with significant ingenuity, there was a prosecutor in Lincoln County a couple years ago who filed a recklessly endangering charge against a man who had sicked his dog on a cat that was being held by a little girl. And of course, the girl ended up being injured in the fracas, and so the charge was recklessly endangering. At the time when there was a motion for an arrest warrant, I said no at the time, and I still don't know quite how it came up. And the reason I didn't sign it was this, is that under what circumstances can an individual be held liable for the actions of a dog or a cat or a pet Bengal tiger? The statutes in Oregon talk about criminal liability, and 161.150 says a person is guilty of a crime if committed by their own conduct or by the conduct of another for which that person is criminally responsible. Now, it uses just the word another without specifying that it refers to a person, but I clearly believe it means another person. And I think that conviction is, or that that conclusion is supported by the very next statute, which is 161.155, that says that a person is criminally liable for the conduct of another person constituting a crime if the person is made criminally liable by the statute defining the crime, or number two, and then in number two, there are three options. With the intent to promote or facilitate the commission of the crime, the person, one, solicits or commands such other person to commit the crime, not dog, but person, or two, aids or abets or agrees or attempts to aid or abet the other person in planning or committing the crime, again, a person, and third, having a legal duty to prevent the commission of the crime, the defendant fails to make an effort the person is legally required to make. Now, there is an affirmative duty on the part of a dog keeper to keep their dog from biting somebody else. But I think that it could be a stretch, and what I think needs to be contemplated by the legislature, in all due respect, is should there be a crime to contemplate that circumstance, or if not a separate new crime, what modification should be made to existing law so that the limitations regarding acting in concert with another person wouldn't preclude criminal liability because you're acting in concert with your pet wolf. I've come up with a couple of ideas, but I didn't even have time to print all that because of the short time we had to get ready. But I think those are, I think it's a concept that needs to be discussed. If, as the CDC says, there are roughly 17 deaths each year in the United States from dog bites, that could happen in Oregon. Now, you may recall, during the 1999 legislature, there was a child in Woodburn who was killed, and it was in between the hearings that I came over here to do. It was between, I think, the first and second appearance. But there was a child in the front yard in Woodburn, and there was a dog tied to the tree, and the dog killed, I think it was the child who lived there. And so that did involve somebody else, but it was a horrendous tragedy. But it could be under circumstances similar to the one in San Francisco, and it's my belief that unless there were some changes made either by enacting a new crime or by amending the provisions about how a person can be liable for the conduct of another, if you add acting in concert with an animal, that there could be trouble in imposing criminal liability under circumstances similar to those in San Francisco. Those are my comments. Happy to answer any questions.
Right. Any questions?
No? Oh, and may I add one other thing,
yes,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee? I wanted, this one knocked me out. And just to underline why the problem is serious. And people, you know, tease about dog offenses, but I'll tell you what, when you're on the receiving end, it's not a joke. One of the items I found was from Newsday, and it was written this week, February 12th, by Kathy Guillermo, who is a writer for People for Ethical Treatment of Animals. And in the article, she talks about her experience or some of the things that have happened since the incident in San Francisco and about another attack in Long Island, pit bulls going after two little boys. And then she says in the middle of her article, "Unfortunately for the dogs and for people who happen to live near them, many breeders of pit bulls and other powerful dogs are attracted to the macho image and even foster aggression in their dogs rather than working to socialize them." And then she says, "Demand for Presa Canarios," I may mispronounce that, "has skyrocketed since Whipple's death." If you can imagine anything sicker than that, the demand for that breed of dog has skyrocketed since those dogs killed that woman. And that's the kind of person we're talking about. We're not talking about Lassie. Anyway, end of comments.
Judge, I appreciate your comments, and certainly appreciate giving us some highlights and some heads up on some of the inconsistencies in statutes where it might be desirable to charge a prosecutor crime if someone uses a dog further their attack on someone. So I appreciate that very much. And we'll move on. Are you going to be able to be with us, or?
I'd like to stay and hear other people's comments. So
okay, great. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but I think it's Jordy Duckler. Is that correct? If I didn't do it right, just...
You did.
I did?
Yes.
Oh, thank you, sir.
That's one out of 200 here somewhere.
John, let me ask you this.
Sir, if you just state your name for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jordy Duckler. I'm an attorney in Portland. I've been an attorney in Oregon for 14 years. I am in a plaintiff's practice, and I just had some comments in support of Senate Bill 166. I wanted to point out to the committee that as far as the law, as far as the common law and statutory law in Oregon is concerned, there has been inconsistencies in the circuit courts that perhaps require there to be a statutory tort in favor of loss of companionship. So I'd like to just address briefly the first section of Senate Bill 166 and not pass an opinion on the rest of the bill. But as far as the first section goes and as far as creating a statutory tort for loss of companionship, this affects the practice. I have the practice I know of a number of plaintiff's attorneys in the Tri-County area in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. And it certainly affects a number of potential litigants as far as what the ability right now for companion pet owners to bring claims against tortfeasors as far as it goes in Oregon right now. For the last two decades, there have been opinions sprinkled throughout the country, including in Florida and New York, suggesting that the companionship between a owner and their pet is the destruction of that relationship is something to be considered as an element of damages in a tort action. It has only been recently that there's been legislation trying to create a statutory tort. Tennessee is one of the few states that's actually created that tort. But under the common law, the decisions have been inconsistent and the idea of having a separate tort of loss of companionship has been something fairly nebulous. In September of 2000, clients of mine, Stan Brock and his family, had their dogs shot and killed by a gentleman wielding bows and arrows, and it was an intentional act of a fairly brutal nature. Suit was brought, and for the first time in Oregon and in the country, 2 weeks ago, a judge, Marco Hernandez, in Washington County Circuit Court, has allowed the tort of loss of companionship to be pled and to go towards trial, and we are now heading towards a trial on a new common law tort. Now, the fact that a Washington County Circuit judge has agreed that that tort is actionable and has agreed that the law of the rest of the country has been developing that way to recognize that relationship is interesting, but it certainly isn't going to support the fact that perhaps judges in Clackamas County or in Multnomah County or in Klickitat County, anywhere else in the state may not agree with that sort of whether that sort of conduct is actionable or not. The fact that Senate Bill 166 would create a statewide consistency as far as allowing that sort of action to be recognized, I think would go a long way towards protecting diverse circuit court opinions and protecting having an appellate court opinions try and wrangle together this idea of the different laws from different jurisdictions, perhaps consider either as an element of damages or an independent cause of action. I do know, and in my practice, I have a number of animal owners who would like to have this sort of statutory protection, and I do know that right now the only possibilities that they have as far as the tort law is concerned is to bring claims for negligence, for conversion, for intentional infliction of emotional distress, for very traditional tort remedies, and that judges are reluctant to do anything other than to allow something like market or special value of the animal to be considered as an element of damage. With a tort that Senate Bill 166 would create and that the common law seems to be heading towards anyway, the idea that the relationship between a companion pet and a companion pet owner has its own intrinsic value and that the destruction of that relationship itself has value is something that could be recognized. This isn't that novel. There are already torts including the torts of intentional interference with business advantage or interference with contractual relations, in which it's recognized that two entities have a relationship, that the relationship is a separate thing, and that thing has a value that needs to be remedied if it's destroyed. This is simply an extension of that idea. The fact that the relationship is between two living beings is, in fact, stronger than the idea of a relationship between a fictional entity like a corporation and a person, or a person in some association of other persons. So I think in that regard, this section of Senate Bill 166 at least recognizes that even without the statutory tort, the common law is heading that way, and this would prevent some inconsistencies. Those are all the comments I have.
All right. Any questions? And you say this case is the first one in the nation where a judge recognized that as a tort?
As far as an actual tort called loss of companionship that actually can head towards a trial, I know of the issue having come up in a case in Wisconsin, the issue of coming up in the case in Michigan, but not actually having a ruling saying that the tort exists. There certainly are opinions from the mid-80s saying that recognizing that there is such a thing as the companionship relationship between a pet owner and its pet, but not saying that there's an independent tort for it. So Oregon is, in a sense, leading the nation right now.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate your comments. Sharon Harmon, Oregon Humane Society. How are you today?
Just fine.
Good.
Good. Senator Minnis, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Humane Society. Conceptually, we like Senate Bill 166. We like the idea that animals have value as companions, and when owners lose that companionship, are entitled to compensation. We do have some issues with other parts of the bill that we would like to sit down and discuss with the other members, both opponents and proponents of this bill, and try to find something that works best for Oregon's animals. So if there is a work group to be assigned, we would welcome the opportunity to participate so we can come out with a bill we all can live with. That concludes my testimony.
Okay, you're supportive, but you obviously think there may need to be some amendments to this.
Definitely. Particularly with Section 1, we are concerned that it applies to Oregon's animal shelters and veterinarians. In dealing with Oregon's tremendous overpopulation problem, should we euthanize an animal because we have run out of options? And while truly nobody likes that to happen, sometimes it does. We feel that we could be held liable under that. We also have concerns with the Section 10. We do want to make sure that courts consider all options before we jump from dog bites person to dog dies. But I'm not sure how you would define aggressively, how it interplays with defensive behavior, all of which can result in tremendous harm to a person. But we like the bill. We would like to see companionship honored and recognized in statutory law.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Association of other persons. So I think in that regard, this section of Senate Bill 166 at least recognizes that even without the statutory tort, the common law is heading that way, and this would prevent some inconsistencies. Those are all the comments I have.
All right. Any questions? And you say this case is the first one in the nation where a judge recognized that as a tort?
As far as an actual tort called loss of companionship that actually can head towards a trial, I know of the issue having come up in a case in Wisconsin, the issue of coming up in a case in Michigan, but not actually having a ruling saying that the tort exists. There certainly are opinions from the mid-80s saying that recognizing that there is such a thing as the companionship relationship between a pet owner and its pet, but not saying that there's an independent tort for it. So Oregon is, in a sense, leading the nation right now.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate your comments. Sharon Harmon, Oregon Humane Society. How are you today?
Just fine.
Good.
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Humane Society. Conceptually, we like Senate Bill 166. We like the idea that animals have value as companions, and when owners lose that companionship, are entitled to compensation. We do have some issues with other parts of the bill that we would like to sit down and discuss with the other members, both opponents and proponents of this bill, and try to find something that works best for Oregon's animals. So if there is a work group to be assigned, we would welcome the opportunity to participate so we can come out with a bill we all can live with. That concludes my testimony.
Okay, you're supportive, but you obviously think there may need to be some amendments to this.
Definitely. Particularly with Section 1, we are concerned that it applies to Oregon's animal shelters and veterinarians. In dealing with Oregon's tremendous overpopulation problem, should we euthanize an animal because we have run out of options? And while truly nobody likes that to happen, sometimes it does. We feel that we could be held liable under that. We also have concerns with the Section 10. We do want to make sure that courts consider all options before we jump from dog bites person to dog dies. But I'm not sure how you would define aggressively, how it interplays with defensive behavior, all of which can result in tremendous harm to a person. But we like the bill. We would like to see companionship honored and recognized in statutory law.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Eileen Stark.
Good afternoon, Chairman Minnis and committee members. My name's Eileen Stark. I work for the Animal Legal Defense Fund, and I'm actually here today to present the written testimony for Pamela Frosch, who could not be here because of family emergency. Ms. Frosch is an attorney and director of the Anti-Cruelty Division of the Animal Legal Defense Fund in Portland, and she's also an adjunct professor of law at the Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College. Senate Bill 166 provides for a number of positive changes to improve the lives of pets and their owners or keepers. My testimony today, however, focuses on Section 1, which allows for non-economic damages for harm done to a companion animal by a third party. Many courts already recognize the special relationship that exists between a cat or dog and his or her keeper. Courts understand that even though animals are considered property under the law, they are not like a television, a table, or a car. They understand that when a person loses his or her pet for whatever reason, the person suffers from grief and an aching sense of loss. When a pet is harmed or killed by a third party, that grief becomes even more acute, knowing that the animal suffered unnecessarily. In our work at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, we receive thousands of communications each year seeking help for their companion animals who have been tortured or killed. We work closely with law enforcement to ensure that animal abusers are criminally prosecuted, but have the difficult task of educating our callers to the reality that they generally have no civil remedy that recognizes the pain they are feeling. Our courts have been similarly frustrated in their attempt to adequately compensate humans for the profound grief they suffer when a third party harms or kills their best friend. Recently, Tennessee became the first state to pass legislation that recognizes the loss of a pet's society, companionship, love, and affection. This was Tennessee Senate Bill 2157, also known as the Tebow Act, passed on May 10th of last year. So Senate Bill 166 is similar to the Thiebaud Act in that it recognizes and allows for appropriate compensation for the loss of the special companionship a love pet can provide. The benefit to having a relationship with a companion animal is real and quantifiable in many cases. For example, studies show that blood pressure lowers and heart rates stabilize when interacting with a pet. Seniors live longer and healthier lives when a pet is in the home. And at-risk children learn important lessons in love, trust, and compassion when made responsible for the well-being of an animal. Companion animals can and do have a profound impact on the quality of our lives. The Humane Society of the United States conducted a national study in the late 1990s asking people about their relationship with pets. The vast majority of respondents stated that they considered their pet to be a member of the family. I'm certain the experience of most of the people in the room today would be consistent with that finding. Any parent who has seen the grief and sorrow experienced by their child at the loss of a beloved pet understands that her pet was more than just a mere dog or cat to the child. It is time to recognize the important place companion animals have in our families and our hearts. It is appropriate and just that we take the next step and allow grieving families to seek civil damages against those who have intentionally or negligently harmed or killed their pets. Therefore, I urge this committee to support Senate Bill 166. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much for reading that into the record. Are you willing to accept questions if there are any?
I'm sorry, I'm really not prepared.
You sure? No, I'm kidding. Okay.
Thank you.
You very much. I appreciate that. Where did my list of witnesses go? Okay. There we are. Mark Fiber, is it?
Fiber.
Fiber. Okay. For Scott B.
Yeah. Well, let me clarify that.
Okay. Sure.
Scott Bickstead was my attorney representing me in a case, in a dog bite case.
Sorry.
What I'd like to do is...
Mr. Chair, I didn't...
He represented me...
Who's he? I didn't hear that.
Scott Bickstead.
Oh, yeah, thank
you. Was my attorney. I'd like to give a little bit of background on what happened to me with that case and give you some background about myself. I work in Lincoln County as a remodeling contractor. I also do community work with as a member of the Mid-Coast Watershed Council. I also raise dogs. I raise Australian Shepherds. And the event that happened to me happened on my private property. It involved the meter reader for the power company. I have a fence yard that's about a third of an acre, and I had six puppies that were about 5 months old at the time. And in the past, when I have bought a puppy, I was responsible to get the inoculations from someone, you know, from a breeder or someone else. And now it's on the other side of the coin where I have puppies that I supply to people. And on that same token, when I give or sell a puppy, I expect they're responsible for inoculations. But what had happened was the meter reader, which was a lady, came onto the property. I was there at the time. It was in the midday. She proceeded to read the meter, and then she came back, and I was standing by the gate so I could open the gate and let her out. She stopped, and she began feeding the puppies. And the puppies were all around her feet, jumping up, and she was feeding them dog treats. And I was standing not more than 2 feet from her, and she had said that one of the pups nipped me. And she proceeded to pull up her pant leg, and I didn't see it, because when you have dogs all around somebody's feet, you can't keep an eye on every single dog. And she looked at her back of her pant leg and pulled up her pant leg and looked at her leg, and I looked at it, and there was no visible marks. So then she proceeded to leave. She seemed a little bit upset. at the time, because she said something about, as a meter reader, that she had the ability to call the authorities, and therefore I could get into a lot of trouble. So after she left, I didn't hear anything more about it for approximately a week. Then I had a message on my voice recorder that said that a deputy of the sheriff's department wanted to talk with me. At that point, I knew that it could only be one thing, so I proceeded to find a lawyer. And by making several calls, I was referred to Scott Beckstead. From then on, I let him handle the situation. He was in constant contact with the police department. What had come up was that at that time it was about 10 days had passed, and the police originally said that they wanted to impound the dog. At that time, I called up the animal control and I asked him what the county ordinance was for impounding in a dog bite case, and they said if the flesh was not broken, then they were not required to take the dog for to monitor the dog. So from my personal experience of being on the site, and the dog did not cause any visible damage, and it was already past or about the 10-day period, I told Mr. Beckstead that I wasn't, or Mr. Beckstead told the police department that he felt that of the same way, and so then there was no more said about it for a couple of days or so. Then all of a sudden, then the police department come back with, did I have all my inoculations for my dogs? And at that time, I could not say that I had my puppies inoculated. And so at that point, must have been into the third week or possibly the end of the second week. When I got home from work, I was met at my property by a sheriff deputy, and I was given a citation for failure to inoculate.
Can I interrupt you for just a second? Okay. I kind of understand where you're going with this, but can you tell us how this bill helps you? Because you're signed up as a supporter of the bill.
Yeah, I'm a supporter of it because I was told under this, by Mr. Beckstead, under the language of the rabies law, that if I did not inoculate my pets, I was in, I was under the a felony charge, the way the bill is written. And Mr. Beckstead had told me that he was surprised the way that he interpreted the law, that I could be charged for a felony. And for an instance where the dog was proven not to have rabies because it had been past the 10-day monitoring period. And so I had to go to court. The DA reduced the charge to a misdemeanor. I told him I was standing there. I didn't see the dog bite, but I pled guilty to the charge as a misdemeanor charge. But the whole point was I could have been charged with a felony for my puppy biting someone because I didn't inoculate my puppies, because if somebody buys my dogs, I expect them to do that.
Right, I understand. So under the current law, the interpretation your attorney made was that you could be charged with a felony.
With a felony charge.
We're not inoculated.
And we're not inoculating my puppies.
And this bill.
This bill, as far as I know, has defined that better than the old law.
Okay.
So that's why I wanted to come and tell you what happened to me.
All right. Well, counsel, we'll highlight that for counsel and make sure that the language of the bill
Okay.
to do what you're asking.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Lana Butterfield and John Clements.
Good Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here today representing Safeco Insurance Companies. Safeco is the largest of the independent agency system companies, and they're located in Oregon, and they're located in Lake Oswego. With me is John Clements. John is a claims analyst for Safeco. He's had 21 years of handling claims, and he'd be able to tell you how Sections 1, 2, and 7 work in real life. So I will let Mr. Clements present our testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Clements, and I'm with Safeco Insurance Company. I'm here to talk about the impact of Senate Bill 166 on insurance policyholders and the insurance mechanism in general. I'd like to... The bill summary indicates that this is creating a new cause of action for the loss of a companion animal, and I think in reality a cause of action already exists, and owners involved in willful, wanton, and negligent kind of actions already are obligated to compensate for the replacement value and the reasonable expenses involved in the loss of a companion animal. This bill greatly expands the available damages in such an action by allowing essentially general damages up to $250,000, as well as punitive damages in addition to that and attorney fees. Involving the insurance mechanism in resolving these kinds of situations, and primarily situations of negligence, does not provide any kind of deterrence for the killing of animals. It impacts homeowners in terms of their insurance, auto insurance in situations where you may be driving down the road and in a routine kind of accident regretfully kill a companion animal, and also business related type of insurances. A humane society could be liable, vets, and any other handlers of animals. I think it increases the incentives and motives for filing insurance claims. The scenarios are, I think, literally unlimited as to how you know, the insurance mechanism could be invoked. I think it increases, potentially increases litigation, because lawsuits involving animals are now going to find their way out of small claims courts into circuit and district court. The stakes are so much higher that there will be a much greater incentive to litigate, where currently these situations are resolved through the current mechanism. It's also going to increase the cost through, because insurance companies are, even in cases of intentional acts, may be required to provide a defense for their insureds. It has the potential of increasing premiums. It can dilute the amount of money available to people who are injured in an auto accident in certain situations. It can dilute the property damage limit in standard auto policies. And I think it's going to create a lot of inequities in trying to decide how much value a companion animal has to his or her owners. So I think the impact is potentially quite great, especially when it involves negligence, but also in situations of intentional acts. And I'd like to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
No questions. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Okay, Glenn Stonebrink. Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and we speak in opposition to this bill. Presently, if someone were to break into your home and in the middle of the night or whenever, and you shot that person, you'd be able to use the fact that they were in your premises as a defense for that shooting. In this bill, on the first page, line 24, when we're talking about the possibility of shooting, let's say, a dog that might be chasing your animal, this bill would take away that defense, the fact that they're on your property. And it refers, and it also refers to ORS 609.150, and that's a section of law that allows a person to kill a dog that is killing your livestock or chasing your livestock. Now, the burden of proof would be on the person who kills the dog if they said, well, the dog was chasing my livestock. Unless you had video or some other means of proving that, the fact that you shot the dog in active chasing the livestock, the fact that it was on your property certainly would be a defense. And what we're saying here is that this bill, but again, the burden of proof would be there. By taking away this, on line 24, taking this away would take away the opportunity of the burden of proof for the livestock owner.
Yeah, I'm not sure I read it that way. It says it is a defense to an action brought under this section if the killing of a companion animal was in defense of a person or another companion animal, or allowed under.
Excuse me, which were you?
Well, on page 2, line 1,
okay.
It says it is a defense to an action brought under this section that the killing of the companion animal was in defense of a person or another companion animal, or allowed under 609.150, which brings in the...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and that's what I'm referring to. I don't have the copy right now, but when you look at 609.150, and that addresses the right to kill an animal, a dog, right, that is killing your livestock or chasing your livestock.
Right.
And what I'm saying is there is a burden of proof. You said, you have a right to shoot this dog if it's chasing your livestock.
Right.
So what I'm saying is, how would you prove that to the livestock owner? And he'd say, well, yeah, I don't have video, I don't have any other way of doing this, except look where the dog is. It's on my property. Then I go back to page 1, line 24, and that may be the only defense he has, because he doesn't have any other evidence at that time. He saw it, but he still has to prove it.
So you're saying a mere trespass is the justification?
This would be, yes, the fact that the dog ended up on, let's say, my land, and I was the shooter. But this would take that away, and it says it is not a defense. That would take away my defense.
I understand what you're saying. And 609.150 does not include trespass as a justification for killing an animal chasing livestock, I'm assuming. I don't have it in front of me either, so.
Mr. Chairman, it allows for the immediate killing if it's killing your livestock or chasing it.
But does not include trespass.
It does not use those words, Mr. Chairman, specifically, but I assume I would make that presumption it's going to be on my land where my livestock are is where the dog was chasing.
I think that's a good issue. It's a good issue to raise. Okay. Thank you very much, and we've come to the end of the witness list on Senate Bill 166. I think I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 166. But before I do, I'm going to ask that we have a work group on this. I'm assuming Senator Courtney has an interest in this since he filed the bill, and I'd like to ask Senator Beyer to assist. At least because you have some agricultural background, and that may help in some of these things. And in working with the interested parties, and I think certainly others that want to participate, if you'll contact Senator Courtney and work through Senator Courtney to get amendments, adjustments to this bill. Close public hearing. Senate Bill 166. And let's see.
working on a heartbeat, right?
Just for people's information, we're not going to get to Senate Bill 230 today. If you're here waiting to testify on Senate Bill 230, we're going to set that over. We have to be out of the committee room a little bit before 3 o'clock. And what we'll do is we'll set that hearing for Thursday the 22nd, Senate Bill 230. So if you can come back. Is there anyone here who traveled more than 100 miles that would like to testify on Senate Bill 230? Anyone traveling more than anyone who cannot return on the 22nd? Good, okay. Do you want to come up and give your testimony on Senate Bill 230?
Huge problem.
Would you? You can if you'd like.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senators, I just want to provide my written testimony and say that I'm supporting Senate Bill 230 and would like you to favorably look at it. I can't be back on that particular date.
So. Okay, and your name again?
Rob Bovet from Lincoln County, a lawyer.
All right. Thank you. And, ma'am, did you want to come up and testify, if you would? Okay, we'll do a public hearing, 230, just to be formal about it.
Good afternoon. My name is Malgosia Cegelski. I'm a licensed psychologist, a PhD psychologist, and a registered play therapist, which means I have a lot of experience in working with children. I now practice in Portland. For 12 years, I practiced in Salem, and before that, I practiced in Alaska. The following information that I'd like to present substantiates the established link between animal abuse, child abuse, domestic violence, and other forms of violence, including the destruction of property. In almost 20 years of experience as a psychologist and as the past director of the Community Mental Health Center in Homer, Alaska, as well as being a consultant to the Battered Women's Shelter in Kenai, Alaska, I have personally come to know that individuals who batter women, abuse children, and abuse animals are typically the same person. It is crucial to understand that animal abuse is not an isolated offense without relationship to other violence. I'm familiar with a study that found that 71% of women in a battered women's shelter reported that their battering partner harmed or threatened to harm their family pet. Women in shelters have actually told me that their husbands terrorized their dogs and cats on a regular basis, and some women wanted to leave the shelter prematurely out of fear that their pet was being harmed while they were not there. I am currently working with a boy in therapy whose mother's boyfriend abused his baby sister until he broke both of her legs. This individual routinely kicked and otherwise tormented the dog, and this is a classic example of animal abuse and child abuse being perpetrated by a single individual. Thousands of cases of animal abuse are reported annually, but not taken seriously and not prosecuted, or prosecuted very rarely. Again, we must stop viewing animal abuse as isolated offenses without relationship to other violence. Documentation exists that in situations where individuals were found to have participated in animal abuse, they also often had lengthy criminal histories of violent crimes. One researcher, Stephen Kellert, who was an FBI agent who writes about his career pursuing serial killers, interviewed violent prisoners in Lebanon.
Anyone traveling more than anyone who cannot return on the 22nd? Good, okay. Do you want to come up and give your testimony on Senate Bill 230?
Huge problem.
Would you? You can if you'd like.
In almost 20 years of experience as a psychologist and as the past director of the Community Mental Health Center in Homer, Alaska, as well as being a consultant to the Battered Women's Shelter in Kenai, Alaska, I have personally come to know that individuals who batter women, abuse children, and abuse animals are typically the same person. It is crucial to understand that animal abuse is not an isolated offense without relationship to other violence. I'm familiar with a study that found that 71% of women in a battered women's shelter reported that their battering partner harmed or threatened to harm their family pet. Women in shelters have actually told me that their husbands terrorized their dogs and cats on a regular basis, and some women wanted to leave the shelter prematurely out of fear that their pet was being harmed while they were not there. I am currently working with a boy in therapy whose mother's boyfriend abused his baby sister until he broke both of her legs. This individual routinely kicked and otherwise tormented the dog, and this is a classic example of animal abuse and child abuse being perpetrated by a single individual. Thousands of cases of animal abuse are reported annually, but not taken seriously and not prosecuted, or prosecuted very rarely. Again, we must stop viewing animal abuse as isolated offenses without relationship to other violence. Documentation exists that in situations where individuals were found to have participated in animal abuse, they also often had lengthy criminal histories of violent crimes. One researcher, Stephen Kellert, who was an FBI agent who writes about his career pursuing serial killers, interviewed violent prisoners in Leavenworth and other federal penitentiaries. He found a statistically significant greater incidence of a history of childhood animal abuse among those prisoners than among other prisoners or in the general population. And another study that studied the records of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals found that these individuals who had been prosecuted for abuse against animals were 5 times more likely to commit violent crimes against people than the general population. Animal abuse is not a stepping stone nor a casual predictor of other violence. It is one of many antisocial acts exhibited by individuals with severe character pathology. This means that these people exhibit a consistent and persistent way of operating in the world that is not particularly amenable to change. Virtually all of the serial killers were animal abusers. I won't present any of the gory details here, but you know who they are. Kip Kinkle, Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler. Youths and adults who abuse animals are perpetrators of violence. This type of behavior does not self-correct. Psychologists view this behavior as one part of a very serious aberration of personality. Margaret Mead stated in The Cause and Prevention of Pathological Homicide, "One of the most dangerous things that can happen to a child is to kill or torture an animal and get away with it." In my profession, it is both legally and ethically mandatory to report child abuse, elder abuse, and threat of physical harm. Many people resisted this legislation not more than 30 years ago. Animal abusers are typically severely mentally sick individuals who will wreak the worst havoc on society until they are stopped. Senate Bill 230 is legislation that will finally allow Oregon to take a step forward with a clear no to this pattern of violent and antisocial destructiveness. Thank you very much for letting me testify.
Thank you. And what I'd like to ask you to do, if you can, since you practice in this area, do you have a survey of some of that research?
Yes, a bibliography is available.
If you could provide kind of a general survey of literature and research that supports your comments today and submit it to the committee, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, Senator Decker, you're here. Do you want to give just some opening comments to 230? I don't know a little bit awkward here because of time, and that's part of the difficulty that we have.
I have one constituent who is plugging her meter, and she did gymnastics to be here today.
All right.
And so I really just want her to be able to testify if that is...
Okay. And so were you planning on testifying yourself also?
I can provide a few comments and stall
for just a few
seconds.
Give us a few comments and we'll just grill you while we're waiting for your...
And feel free to... Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the rationale for this bill came about, and the prior testimony alluded to it a little bit. We've heard a number of cases in the media recently about Rose 2 at the Oregon Zoo, about Purpur, and many others. But what I've learned, and there was a work group that met during the last year and a half on this issue, and it was Karen Haberle, who will be with us momentarily. Her and her son witnessed the abuse of the elephant at the zoo. And that was the first indication that I had received of the problem that we have in our statutes. And you'll hear a great deal of testimony, a few comments this afternoon, and many more next Thursday on this, because what we've learned is in that case, you cannot prosecute the individual because our statutes need to be updated in terms of our animal abuse statutes. We have tried in this effort, and in this bill, Senate Bill 230, to craft a solution to this problem, a well-reasoned and tightly knit and tightly focused solution that really deals with these extreme cases of animal abuse, exempting and paying particular attention to exempt out hunting or livestock or any other form that would not fall into a narrow category of animal abuse. And so that was the real passion behind this bill. We've had a work group from all over Oregon that has worked very diligently in the last 2 years to come up with this product. We feel it's at least the start to the solution of some of these cases, whether they're the celebrated cases that we hear about or the everyday cases that unfortunately you don't hear about, but would allow, and so you will hear from, in the course of the testimony, district attorneys, prosecutors, law enforcement, folks at the Humane Society, an individual from Metro, because of their inability to prosecute this one individual who they would have liked to prosecute. And there was a great deal of interest in doing so, and our statutes here in Oregon simply precluded that from happening. So you'll hear a great deal of testimony from citizens throughout Oregon on this issue of updating our animal abuse statutes. I appreciate the chair for his interest in this issue and the members of the committee. And with that, I would like to introduce a constituent of mine. Karen was really the person that first brought this to my attention because she is the one, and I'll let her catch her breath. She is the individual who first identified this problem and said, shouldn't there be a law? Shouldn't there be statutes that really address this? And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will entertain any questions, or I will let Mrs. Haberle describe her experience, and I appreciate you allowing us to testify this afternoon.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Ms. Haberle, is that correct?
Would you mind if I get my bifocals?
You can get your bifocals. I understand.
I heard a good joke this afternoon, Mr. Chair.
You did. You want to share it with? Was it about me? That's what
It had nothing. No, it had nothing to do. Senator Corcoran told it, though.
Well, maybe not might be appropriate for this committee.
I apologize for any inconvenience. My name is Karen Haberle. I would like to sincerely thank Chairman Minnis and the members of the committee for your time. First, I would like to say that I'm not an activist or a member of a group, only a mom who went to visit the zoo with my children. And on December 21st, 1999, I took my child to the zoo for their camp to learn about why we need to protect and preserve our animals. My other child, who was 3 at the time, decided he wanted to visit the animals that day also, especially the elephants. My son and I entered the elephant house at approximately 9:30 a.m. At this time, the elephants were being removed from their leg chains, when the baby, Rose 2, was struck not once but twice a few minutes apart. The elephant handler, Fred Mairn, screamed red-faced at the baby for not following his commands. He swung the back of a hooked club into her front shoulder with a full hard swing. Rose, too, did not move or gesture in any way which would seem threatening to Fred Mairn. In fact, there were three other handlers present, and Fred asked for no help. In fact, she was still in full leg chains. At this point, my three-year-old child asked, "Mommy, why is the man hitting the baby elephant?" This question, still to this day, I cannot answer for him with a feeling of closure. This, Chairman Minnis and members, is something my child will remember for the rest of his life. I asked Fred why he hit the baby, and his response was, "I would really not want to hear what goes on around here." Then he laughed. It's very hard to sit here and explain my witness of Rose 2 being abused because Fred Mairn is still able to have access to animals. If my witness to the abuse was used to bring charges against Fred Mairn, maybe the abuse when Rose 2 received 176 wounds plus other injuries at the hands of Fred Mairn maybe would have never happened. The zoo was fined $10,000 and are required to improve training for their handlers, and Fred Mairn was dismissed, but he did receive back wages. And there are no criminal charges against Fred Mairn to this day. If Bill 230 were in place, the district attorney could have proceeded with their case to press charges. Please, I ask for your support on Bill 230 so the offenders will feel less compelled to violence if they know there will be a law in place which can place them in jail. Thank you so much for your time and efforts, because they will make a difference.
All right, thank you, Ms. Haberle. Any questions? Senator, thank you, and appreciate your testimony. I think, given the time, I think we'll just kind of proceed in this particular bill. Hopefully nobody left. We'll pass over my bill, Senate Bill 227, which I wanted to get to. But I'm not throwing a fit or anything. So we'll move on then. If you don't mind, then I'll go back up to Steve Otto from Multnomah County, who signed up first. I apologize for what appears to be a very disjointed chair. Senator Bell. In the judgment of the Willamette Week, think about
right?
it.
Both powerful couples.
Oh, 50. I don't know who the other 49 are.
Yeah.
Who
do they think they are?
Exactly.
I mean, if they're number 50, who's number one?
Be up there. Okay.
Who can be number one? If they're number 50,
Mr. Otto.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephan Otto. I'm an attorney with the Animal Legal Defense Fund in Portland, and helped draft much of what's before you today. It's been nearly 6 years since any substantive changes were made to Oregon's animal protection laws. During this period, significant issues and problems have been identified with parts of these laws that now warrant their review. My testimony today will provide an overview of these concerns and then focus on the specific changes proposed by this bill and the proposed amendments that are included in the packet. And we believe that these will go a long way to solving some of the serious deficiencies in the current status of the law. To begin with, Oregon's law enforcement community has identified problems in sections of the current laws that make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to successfully prosecute many serious cases of animal abuse. One such problem is with the current definition of physical injury suffered by an animal. The current definition borrows the same definition that we use for physical injury on a person, and it requires, in part, the need to prove that the animal suffered substantial pain. The difficulty for prosecutors arises because, unlike animals, unlike people, cannot express the degree or severity of the pain that they are suffering. Senate Bill 230 changes the definition from one now requiring a great degree of subjectivity to one with a more objective standard. Another important issue is that while animals themselves are fully deserving of strong legal protections, numerous studies that witness already testified demonstrate another critical reason for taking these crimes seriously. These studies continue to confirm a disturbing fact that the strong link between cruelty towards animals and other violent antisocial behavior. As was mentioned previously, people who abused animals were 5 times more likely to commit violent crimes against people. In recognition of this link and other deficiencies in the current law, Senate Bill 230 proposes a number of reasonable and necessary improvements. These are necessary for a number of reasons, but are primarily crafted to address the concerns raised by law enforcement who want improvements enacted in order that they may more effectively protect our communities. Senate Bill 230, together with the proposed amendments, will go a long way in addressing these concerns. Other testimony today and next week will discuss these concerns in greater detail. I plan to devote the bulk of my testimony to discussing the substantive changes in the bill and answering questions that you might have. Before delving into details, I want to let you know that there's a broad coalition of supporters for this bill. And this is due much to the credit of Senator Deckert and Connie Haas, who are here today. And it ranges from police, prosecutors, humane societies, animal welfare agencies, veterinarians, and citizens from all across the state. We share at least one important thing in common here today, and that's a commitment to ending violence in our communities, whether it takes the form of animal abuse or is manifested in some other fashion. Now, I'd be happy to talk about what exactly this bill does, if you'd like. There's two approaches we can do. If you'd like, I could go through section by section and discuss exactly what it does.
I think what I'd like to do before you go through the section by section, I'd like to get some of the public comment on the bill.
Okay.
Because this is going to be like the previous one. More likely than not, it will be in a work group where there will be some amendments and changes to it. So rather than going there, I'll try to get some of the other testimony on if I can.
Very good.
Okay. And we'll call you back up or you make right. yourself available.
Thank you.
Tom Buchholz.
My name is Tom Buchholz, and I was 1991 convicted of animal neglect. In the real world, we have the Oregon State Criminal Code 161.005, and that includes animal neglect, animal abandonment, animal abuse, and 167.350, which is a forfeiture hearing. That's in the real world. In the actuality, in my neck of the woods, what they do is they take the criminal code, which is to be enforced by officers who are have some level of competency deemed by the state to enforce, and they take the animal neglect, animal abuse, and animal abandonment, and they turn them into civil infractions. That's just for us little guys that may only have one dog. So what happens is we go to court. We are denied, first of all, the right to a jury. We have to suffer with preponderance of evidence for a level of evidence, and we have to we have no rights to forfeiture hearings, and we have no rights to search warrants. That's I lived in Multnomah County at the time. So the part that I am objecting to this is the part where they have taken out the word search warrant, which is back here in the back. And it says they want to put in the any manner authorized by law. Well, up there in Portland, we have an auto dealer named Scott Thomason who will finance anybody the law allows. And I don't know what, that doesn't make much sense to me. I always scratch my head when I hear it on the TV. I look at this, and what does the authorized by law mean? It doesn't tell me anything as a private citizen. I could go to the book and I could look up and it says search warrant. I go, ha ha, they're supposed to have a search warrant. So, you know.
Hey, Senator Duncan has a question.
Yes, sir. It's right here, sir. It's mine's different. I got it off the internet. It's 167, number 2 here. Yeah, it says they want to take out, there's probable cause to leave any animal. Then it says plus, they want to add, a peace officer in any manner authorized by law. And what they're taking out is below it. It says a peace officer after obtaining a search warrant in a manner authorized by law. And
what section is it? Do you have a section?
Section 2 under 167.345
of the bill. It's
I got mine off the internet, so
section 13, page 4 of the printed bill. So you're objecting to the deletion of the language that says...
I'm going to delete to the search warrant, sir.
Okay.
In Multnomah County, they hadn't, for like 2.5 decades, got a search warrant until I forced them to put it into their ordinances. They come on your property without search warrants, the animal control officer does. They take your animal, and then you're given only 144 hours, or they kill your dog. That's how it's done in Multnomah County. Had they taken rape in the criminal code, turned it into a civil infraction, and let the animal control enforce it, I probably wouldn't need to be here today. But they've taken the animal abuse, animal neglect, and animal abandonment, and they let people who are not trained to any particular standard of training enforce it. I think that's a violation of my civil rights and anybody else in Multnomah County. Also, we get back here farther and we deal with 167.347. Well, I think the people of Oregon have already spoke on that issue. Major 3. We had, 952,762 people say no, they don't want you to be forfeit your rights before you have a criminal trial. What happens before the criminal trial is, in 167.347, is that you are taken into court by a humane society or an animal control, and your animal is forfeited to them before you go to trial. The problem with that is the standard of proof here, again, is not beyond a reasonable doubt. It is just a preponderance of the evidence. And I have a particular case here that was before the Supreme Court. It's the Mr. William Thomas Brandstetter. He had like 11 horses and one mule. And he was taken to a forfeiture hearing before he was going to court. And he was made to give up those mules and that horse under the preponderance of the evidence. And because he couldn't come up with the $2,700 it took to feed him was, I guess, the estimation. So in actuality, what this organization did was they realized between $9,600 to $15,000 worth of animals for only $2,700. Mr. Brandstetter was found innocent in a court of law at a higher standard of proof before his a jury of his peers. He had no recourse. It was a bad day. Yes, sir.
Just so you know, all the issues relevant to Measure 3 are actually being worked out in another proposal.
I understand, but I put in here, and I just kind of resent the fact that it's even in this.
What I'm telling you is we're not going to include any provision in statute that we know is contrary to Measure 3.
Okay, that's fine. I'm just...
We can't do that, so...
Okay, so I guess what I'm really upset about is the fact that you want to take search warrants out of this bill.
Okay, sir.
In Multnomah County, the animal control officers never got search warrants. I have stuff here that they haven't got them for years, and that's because they're not held to any kind of training. And
did you say originally you were convicted of some...
Yes, animal neglect, sir.
Animal neglect.
Yes, the officer came into my house, took my dog. left a note saying I had 144 hours to get my dog. So I called them up. I said, what's the problem here? And they said, well, you're going to be charged. Bring some ID. You're going to be charged with animal neglect. And we're going to kill your dog if you don't come by Monday. And I said, kill my dog. So I went over there, and they didn't like my attitude when I got there because they read the officer's report, and none of it was true. So I went over there, and I kind of like was slapping my thing in my hand, and then all of a sudden it came down to the point where we don't like your attitude. You're not getting your dog back. So I went out in my car, and I sat there for a while, and I waited for the place to fill up, and I went back and got on my knees and begged for my dog and got my dog back. The lady in the case after mine...
I got a dog yesterday, took the photo now, right? So,
this is the same report.
Any questions about this officer, about the dog that allegedly was in park?
What they did was they killed her dog before she had
Yes, I do have a question. You told me that you would give me time to get the medical bills to you. You went on vacation. You didn't return my phone calls. I must have left. Very emotionally upset because I could not find the owner of the dog. I was very honest with the Humane Society, and I said, I found a home for him. I want to come out and get him. They would not release him to me because I admitted that I was not the owner of the dog. When the owner came back into town, he had already been destroyed. And they were on vacation.
To me, this lady was entitled to a search warrant on her property, which she never got, and also her dog was destroyed before she had a chance for a forfeiture hearing. And it's being done that way today.
Multnomah County.
Yes, sir. And it's being that way done today. I have the paperwork right here. And it's also Clackamas County. They just passed a bunch of ordinances. They do a heck of a lot of impounding, but they don't have the word search warrant in their ordinances either.
So what do you want them to do with search warrants? I'm not exactly sure.
Sir, it's in the law.
But what do you want them to do with search
warrants? I want the officers to get the search warrants before they remove the animals. They are allowed to come in the yard and take care of the animals.
I see. So you want them to obtain a search warrant before they actually...
There needs to be some kind of accountability for it.
Okay.
The whole issue here is that this is...
I just want to know. They came and got your dog?
Yes, sir.
Why did they come and get your dog?
They said I was abusing my dog. He said in his affidavit, he said my dog was in direct sunlight. My dog had no air for circulation. In fact, my dog was underneath the carport and was in a chain-link fence.
That's the only allegation, is the dog was in sunlight?
No, he said there was no water also, but he stood 18 feet away to take a picture of the water bucket. That's the reason I've tried to get these guys training, because he took a picture underneath the carport that didn't even show the carport. So when he went to write his thing, he wrote the evidence from his pictures.
What kind of dog do you have, please?
I had a Rottweiler, sir.
Okay, thank you.
In a pen, minding his own business.
Thank you.
The whole issue that comes to mind here is that they were after my roommate. So they take your dog. You have to go get your tickets in court or at the dog pound.
Okay. All right, I think I understand what you're trying to tell me. You want them to have a search warrant before they actually take the dog, as opposed to doing it under extra circumstances.
No, Well, extra circumstances says under extra circumstances that they need to have the search warrant in the bill as it is written today.
All right. Okay, Mr. Buchholz, right?
Yes, sir, Buchholz.
Buchholz, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. We're going to go ahead and adjourn. Just before we do, we'll do cleanup testimony, I guess, on Senate Bill 230 on the 22nd, Thursday, next week. And Senate Bill 227, we will do the public hearing on Wednesday, the 21st. And with that, any other business?